stop and say, okay, we're on the move. Good. This is how it works. Go down the corridor, the whole corridor, that V-shape. Back and forth, one lap is a quarter mile. So all I have to do is count the laps and I know how far I've gone. All right? And I wanted to do a 5-miler yesterday, so I went and did a 5-miler.
Wow.
Okay? And that's, well, you know, I've got this foot race in April I have to get ready for, so. But I talk too much about that. We have to talk about this, and this is the wrap-up day for the unit. I would like you people to get news out to the absentees about what's going on. Whitney, we know her situation. Rachel is sick as a dog, and I emailed her this morning, and I told her not to even dare come back to school while she's still the slightest bit sick. She needs to get well first, and that whatever needs to be done about due dates for stuff will be done on her return, and I let her know what was coming down the road in the immediate future. So the person to get word to is Amanda. Now, here's how it's going to work. Here's what I want you to be prepared to do, no matter what happens, and depending on how circumstances fall out, we'll make the necessary adjustments. But assume everything is going to be happening the way I originally laid it out. That means you should assume the test is coming Thursday, and that the due date for the research paper is a week from Thursday. Get the idea? The reason why I'm doing that, as I said before, is because I don't want you coming back from a long break and having to turn in the research paper the first day you're back.
Are you giving in your note cards and stuff?
No, just the final job. Just the final job.
In the bibliography or no?
Yes, it needs a bibliography on it. Absolutely. Absolutely. That's part of the final package. Yes. It does need that. So, I need the final paper from you with bibliography a week from Thursday. Now, assume the test is going to happen Thursday as well. We're going to play that game, even if the weather knocks us out tomorrow. Keep that idea firmly in mind. Assume the test will happen tomorrow. I'll reserve judgment as to whether I'll actually give it, because if you prepare for the test the day after tomorrow, you'll be all the better set no matter what happens. You see what I'm saying? And you want to do that. You don't want to counter the bad weather to knock out Thursday's test. Yes?
Do you have a title page?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes. Have a title page for your research paper and have a bibliography. Absolutely. All right? So keep those things in mind. So assume for the time being. I think we're going to be back in school tomorrow, by the way. But I don't know.
Wait, if we aren't, then the research paper will be moved.
I'm not saying that. I'm saying be prepared for the test on Thursday no matter what. You understand?
Okay, but if there's a survey tomorrow, then we'll
be prepared for the test on Thursday no matter what. All right? If after seeing what's happened on the snow day, I decide to delay the test, then you're that much further ahead. But be ready. Do you understand? Don't bet against fate. Got it? Which is about the mystery religions on the middle panel here. And we're going to get to those momentarily. This stuff is not as bad as it looks. This stuff is not as bad as it looks, but it certainly is a wrap-up of everything that we've been doing in this unit. And you'll notice I've tweaked the dates of the Hellenistic Age, which actually started as Philip was conquering Greece, but I pegged it today to the year that Alexander actually died. So this is stuff that happens in the Greek-speaking world after Alexander. We know, for example, that Greek culture is now spreading into Asia. We've already done that. One of the results is that if you want to make money or you want to learn something, what's the language you have to understand?
Greek.
You have to understand Greek. It becomes the language of scholarship and it becomes the language of trade all over the Mediterranean world as well. And when we get to the next unit in Rome, we're going to find out that this was true for the Romans as well as for the Greeks. If the Romans wanted to trade or they wanted to learn philosophy or science, they had to learn Greek. And they did. By the time of the Roman Empire, It was the mark of somebody who had some elegance and intelligence and learning to know Greek as well as Latin in the Roman speaking in the Roman world. But these are the trends, and the most important thing to keep in mind is that the experiment of democracy that came out of Athens is over as far as the Greek-speaking world is concerned. The matter where Greek armies march during this period of time, the matter where Greeks rule, and this was true in Greece and in Southwest Asia alike, what's the form of government all the time now?
Monarchy.
It's monarchy. So, what does that mean for any chance for ordinary people to shape their political destiny?
It's gone.
It's gone. They don't control it anymore. The only thing they can control is how they respond to guess whose orders?
The king.
The king or the queen. That's it. That's it. It's no longer about power. It's about duty. If it's about duty at all. All right? And this is one reason why you get the stuff on this second panel. You're going to see the development of a series of new philosophies around 300 BC where people retreat out of political life for the most part. Or if they take part in political life, it's as people who obey. Now, this is where the matching exercise comes in, and this is what you're going to do right now. I've given you three people and three descriptions of the philosophies here. What I would like you to do is match one to the other. Where does Zeno go? Where does Epicurus go? That's pretty much given away. And where does Diogenes go? Obviously, the easiest one is Epicurus. Yeah. Okay? So there's a match. We know that. Incidentally, there's a difference between Epicureanism and hedonism. Hedonism is go out and party. Epicureanism isn't go out and party. Epicureanism is more about living a balanced, enjoyable, moderate life. You don't go getting stoned. You don't go getting drunk. You don't go getting hungover or strung out. You don't go crashing on drugs. That's hedonism. Epicureanism is something entirely different, because it's also about maintaining good health. Okay? Now, try the other two.
I think Diogenes is Stoicism.
Nope. So that takes care of that. Now try this on for size. Diogenes, it is said, didn't even live in a house. He lived in a castaway old barrow, and he wore animal skins. He simplified his life extremely. He spent most of his time out of doors. And there's a story about Diogenes meeting Alexander the Great, because Alexander the Great liked to advertise himself as somebody who could bear physical deprivation without crying or complaining or whining or anything like that. And he knew that Diogenes was a pretty tough guy as well. And he thought Diogenes was really cool. Now, Diogenes lived in Asia Minor, what's now Turkey, even though he was a Greek. He lived in one of those Greek colonies in Asia Minor. And as Alexander was marching in to conquer the Persian Empire, the story goes that he met Diogenes, who incidentally carried a lantern around with him all the time at night. People used to ask Diogenes, why do you have this lantern with you all the time? And Diogenes' answer was, I'm looking for the truth. It's a pretty scarce commodity. Yeah, and he was pretty sour about people's dispositions. He thought that we were inclined to lie rather than tell the truth. So he carried this lantern around and said, I'm looking for the truth. Anyway, Alexander said to have met him, and basically said, Diogenes, you're really cool. I admire you. You're intelligent. You have some really good ideas on how to live and how to be brave. And I would like to do anything that I can for you. Well, as it turned out, that when the two were talking, this was in the broad daylight, Alexander was standing up and Diogenes was squatting on the ground, and Alexander cast a shadow on Diogenes. Guess what Diogenes said when Alexander said, I'll give you anything you want.
Move,
get out of my light. That was his reply. Simple as that. Now, think of some philosophies we've studied before. What Chinese philosophy does cynicism remotely resemble?
Taoism.
Yeah, yeah. It's kind of like a Greek version of Taoism.
What was the most popular?
There wasn't the most popular. I'll tell you which one was the most popular with the Romans eventually, because they took it on. Stoicism.
Yeah.
Okay? And let me tell you how it got to be called Stoicism. Remember the Agora? Remember what an Agora is in a Greek city?
Is that the highest?
No, that's the Acropolis. What's the Agora?
It's the marketplace.
It's the marketplace, and it's a place where public meetings take place. Good. Excellent. Okay? Now, the reason why Stoicism is called Stoicism is because it's named for another Greek word. And the Agora, around the edge of the Agora in Athens, was a stoop where people could sit down. Now guess what the Greek word for stoop is? It's up there.
Stoa.
Stoa, all right. Now, Zeno used to teach his students while they were sitting on the stoop in the Agora in Athens. He used to teach outdoors. So, guess what his philosophy becomes? What's the word?
Stoicism.
Stoicism, the philosophy of the stoop. That's how it got its name. Okay? Now, notice here, as we're talking about this, that what's happening to the degree to which people think or feel they can control their destiny. Is it going up or is it going down?
Going down.
It's going down. And one of the results of this is that people turned to various mystery religions, which carried on not only in the late Greek world, but in the Roman world as well. And two of the most important were the worship of Tyche, and you can see what you have there. Problem with Tyche was that she had moves. She was unpredictable. You better stay on her good side. If you don't, what's likely to happen to you?
Death.
Yeah. And suffering on the way. Not an easy death. Now, the other was the worship of Isis and Osiris out of Egypt. And what you have here is the idea that everything dies sooner or later, but everything can be reborn. Now, why do you think that would come out of a place like Egypt? What happens every year in Egypt that helps the crops grow and helps the crops come back?
It floods.
Right, the Nile flood. Okay? So this is, the Egyptians were particularly attached to the cycle of death and rebirth, which they thought was controlled by gods. And what happened was that Isis's husband, Osiris, would die every year, and she would bring him back to life. Now, notice that I've put the word resurrection down here. This is a perfect time of year to do this, the season of Lent in Christianity, which was preparation for what holiday? Easter. Okay. Do you see the connection between that idea and Christianity? That eventually is going to come? Basically what's happening is that the Greek-speaking world is being prepared. Nobody knew this at the time. It was all by way of coincidence and accident. Being prepared for the eventual coming of Christianity. Although there's a trick here. These are mystery cults. Are their ceremonies public or are they secret?
Secret.
They are secret. It's like joining a secret club. In order to join the secret club, what do you think you had to do?
Go through a ceremony.
Yeah, you had to go through an initiation ceremony. Do you think that ceremony came for free?
No.
No. You became a member of an organization. So periodically, what else would you have to do? You would have to pay fees to worship in the temples. Exactly. Exactly. So these were secret clubs. That's different from early Christianity, as we'll see later on when we do the Roman world. But the point is that these mystery religions are spreading at this time. And keep in mind what is happening here. Our fate is in whose hands?
The gods.
Right. Right. If you want to get on their good side, subscribe to one of these religions. Join the club. All right? Now, the fourth panel. Boy, we're going through this rapidly. This is cool. Because there's an insurance against the snow day. Bad weather day. We haven't dignified this winter with anything really resembling snow. It's been Jersey glop. But we shall see what we shall see. Boy, we're traveling rapidly through this. It looked like a lot, but you see how speedily we're getting this done? Okay, now, before we can figure this fourth panel out, I need from you a way of telling me the difference between geocentrism and heliocentrism. It's about what's at the center of the universe. Any ideas?
Geocentric is the Earth, and heliocentrism is the Sun.
That's right. Geos means Earth. Good. Excellent. 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 Geos is Greek for Earth. And the word for Sun is Helios. You got the idea. Okay? Now, the debate was between Aristarchus on one side and Aristotle, later reinforced by the mathematics of an Egyptian astronomer, an Egyptian Greek by the name of Claudius Ptolemy, who lived almost 500 years after Aristotle. Okay? Got the idea? All right. Now, who was on whose side? That's my first question. Second is, who won? And the third question is, why? Tell me what you think.
Aristarchus was heliocentrism.
Exactly. You just got it. Aristarchus. Now, this is the point. Who's the first to come up with the idea that the sun is the center of the universe?
Galileo.
No.
Yeah, Aristarchus.
It's Aristarchus. That's the whole point. Galileo, 1900 years later, came up with some physical evidence for that by using what instrument which he claimed to invent?
The telescope.
He did not actually invent it. The Dutch did in the 1590s, but Galileo was a notorious cheat and plagiarist, and he took credit for it. He did some important original work. I'm not saying he was a dummy, far from it, but he was kind of like the Bill Belichick of the scientific world. You get my meaning, guys? Brilliant, but inclined to shade things a little bit, if you believe the stories against Mr. Belichick. All right, now, ever hear of Copernicus?
Oh, yeah.
All right.
No.
Now, did Copernicus originate the idea of heliocentrism, or did he revive it?
Revived.
He revived it. All right, now, that means which side won the argument? That's right, the geocentrists won. Now, nowadays, we would think that claim about the nature of the universe is absolute nonsense. So I've got to ask you one more question. Why do you think they won? Why do you think they won?
That the sun or the earth was the center of everything that revolved around it.
How did he know that? How would he come to that conclusion?
Because that's what it looks like.
He's standing on the earth. What does it feel like? Does it feel like it's moving anywhere?
No.
He looks upward from the earth, and what does he see both day and night? The clouds, the sun, the moon, and the stars. What are they all doing? They're moving. The earth is still. Right? Now, Aristotle believed in basing your ideas on direct observation. As a result of doing that, right? As a result of doing that, what conclusion did he come up with?
Geocentrism.
Earth is still, everything else moves. Therefore, what's at the center of the universe?
The Earth.
The Earth. Easy! Makes total sense. Anybody who believes differently is dumb. And Ptolemy reinforced the idea by doing some mathematical calculations with the math that was available to him during those days. So why do you think heliocentrism eventually won the argument?
They found new evidence.
They found new evidence. That's where Galileo comes in.
That proved that geocentrism is not actually how it works.
Not only that, when Copernicus published his book on the revolutions of the heavenly bodies in 1543, the year of his death. He actually had his information all together during in the year 1514, but he was a Catholic priest and he didn't dare publish it because there was something going on called the Inquisition. And if he published something the church didn't believe in, guess what was going to happen to him?
You
die.
Burned at the stake.
Burned at the stake. Yeah, they'd tie you to a stake, light a fire underneath your feet, and roast you alive. Copernicus did not want to go through that, so he delayed publishing this data. But with Copernicus, you'll learn this next year, the heliocentric idea was a hypothesis. Basically, he did this. He said, if you look at the sky and you do the mathematical calculations that track the motions of the stars and the planets, and remember, none of these guys had a telescope available to them. That wouldn't come till the 1590s AD. Copernicus said, look, if you assume the sun is at the center of the universe, the mathematics that explains the motion of heavenly bodies is a lot easier than the mathematics that assumes that the earth is at the center. Get the idea? Now, there's a rule in philosophy that if you have to choose between explanations for something, which one is the better rule?
The simpler one.
Follow the simpler rule, not the complicated one. Get it? If you've got two rules that equally explain why something's happening and you have to choose between the simple one and the complicated one, you always choose which again?
Simple.
The simple one. All right? You'll learn the name for that rule next year. It's called Occam's Razor. It's named after an English priest who lived around 1300 named William of Ockham. Good! You got it! Okay? Now, what you've learned about Aristotle and direct physical observation will figure into some of this review. Okay? But we'll get to that in a minute. Scientific discoveries. Last panel. Here we go. It's another matching exercise. The question is, who did what? All right? See what you can do with it. Once you've done the matching exercise, we're finished with almost everything, and we can start turning the corner directly into a little review work, which will give you some insurance for Thursday, just in case the weather gets tricky on us. All right? So, go for it.
Euclidean geometry.
All right.
Archimedes is the displacing order.
All right, I'm going to stop there. I'm going to throw it to everybody else.
Wait, time? She said one.
All right, Archimedes is displacement of water. You know how that works?
Yeah, with the pipes.
The mass of the displaced water is equal to the mass of the object.
Yeah. You know how he figured it out?
Something that being in the bathtub.
Yeah, he put himself in a bathtub. He weighed himself. Put himself in a bathtub and had a container into which the water spilled over the lip of the bathtub. And then he weighed the container and what did he find out?
It was his mess.
All right, it was a match. All right. Okay. Ashley, you need to be silent. Time for other people to carry this load. How about the other four? Democritus?
Democritus is the early one.
Yeah, that's right. First atomic theory, it came out of Einstein, came out of Democritus 2,500 years earlier, although he didn't know about atomic nucleus, electrons, protons, anything of that. He said all matter is made up of irreducible, indivisible, tiny things, which he called
atoms.
Okay, so he's the first to come up with that idea as a hypothesis.
Is anatomy heterogeneous?
All right. Excellent. Herophilus does anatomy. Establishes it as a science, as a branch of what? If you're doing surgery.
Medicine.
Okay. All right. We've got two more. Eratosthenes and Theophrastus.
Sneeze is an accurate calculation.
That's right.
How did he do that?
That's, oh, excellent question. We're going to come to that in a minute. All right. So that means that Theophrastus is the botanist. And by the way, what's botany?
It's going.
Study of plants. All right. Now, in what fields would that be useful? Study how plants grow in order to improve what?
Agriculture.
Agriculture and what else?
Medicine.
Medicine for pharmaceuticals. Exactly. Okay. Good job. Okay. By the way, before we get to how Eratosthenes calculated the circumference of the Earth, he did it with trigonometry. By the way, here's my other question. Who is more accurate about the circumference of the Earth? Eratosthenes or Columbus?
Eratosthenes.
Columbus was 8,000 miles off.
This guy was only like 200.
Not even that, 170. He was pretty close. Now, let me give you an idea. You can do this in several steps, and they're quick and easy. All right? How did Eratosthenes figure this out? Eratosthenes worked at the Library of Alexandria. Okay? So this is part of Alexander's heritage that he passes on to the future of the world. He's in Egypt. All right? Now, you guys know enough about world geography to know about the equator and the Tropic of Cancer and the Tropic of Capricorn, right? You know about that? And you know the Earth is on a tilt, right? 23.5-degree tilt from straight up and down, which explains why we have seasons. Now, here's how it works. You know what a solstice is when the sun reaches its farthest reach? Okay. Now, when is the summer solstice?
June or July 21st.
Excellent. June 21st. Okay. Excellent. Good. So this is what Eratosthenes did. He said, he knew that at the summer solstice, the sun shone directly down onto Earth at the Tropic of Cancer, which passes through southern Egypt. So this is what Eratosthenes did. He took a trip up the Nile to southern Egypt. All right, it was a several hundred mile trip. And when he got to that spot, which he was able to calculate mathematically, when he got to that spot, this is how he did it. This is how he found out he was in the right spot. It took him several years to do this. He guessed where it was, and he was finally able to find the right spot, and he found it by driving a stake in the ground and noticing that at noontime on June 21st, what didn't it cast? There was no shadow, which meant that the sunlight was coming straight down. Got it? Now, he left that stake in the ground, and he watched it for a number of days. He watched it for at least a full month. And as the days went by, what happened with the shadow?
It grew.
It grew. And he calculated the angle of the shadow from the pole day by day. And using trigonometry, he was then able to calculate what?
The circumference.
The circumference. That's how he did it. Now you can see that this is an experiment that takes a while to perform. There has to be a lot of direct physical observation first. And that goes back to our friend Aristotle. Okay? Can I take some of this off the board and do a little beginning of review? A couple of things with you? Okay. Here's what we're going to do. Two things. And I want to cover with you that I didn't treat fully in the heart of the unit. Okay? And here they are. In fact, there are three. All right? Remember we talked about sophists, those tutors that taught people in Athens how to debate and win debates, tricks of argument? All right? Now, the most important of these sophists in Athens was a guy named Anaxagoras. You need to remember that name. You want to take it down. All right? Now, Anaxagoras lived around 450 BC. In Athens. Guess who he taught, who broke away from the sophists?
Socrates.
He taught Socrates. Good. Excellent. Who in turn taught? Who's the next?
Plato.
He flourished around 380 BC. And Plato in turn taught whom?
Aristotle.
Who was active around 340 BC, who in turn taught?
Alexander.
There you go. All right. Now, there was a philosophical duel between Plato and Aristotle as to what the ultimate nature of reality is. I'm going to write two statements here. These are two opposing propositions, all right? In this one, ideas form physical reality. In this one, physical reality forms ideas. Which philosopher, and that, by the way, that debate's still going on in philosophy, even now. The choice is between Plato and Aristotle. Who believed what proposition?
Plato is the
first one. That's right. You got it. Aristotle is here. Plato is there. Excellent. Let's do a political one. You guys have this down pretty well?
Yeah.
All right, can I blow it off the board? All right. I want to dig a little deeper into the development of Athenian politics, okay? Have you ever heard the word draconian?
Yeah.
You know what it means?
No.
It means harsh and cruel. Draconian. It has a Greek origin, all right? It's named after a guy named Draco. Here we go. This is politics, okay? Okay, here we go. Who said we don't want people to pay a financial penalty for going to meetings at the Ecclesia, the Athenian Assembly? They ought to be paid to come.
Solon?
No.
Cleisthenes?
No. I'll give you a hint, the embezzler.
Pericles.
Okay?
No,
yeah, Pericles, the hustler. Okay? All right. Remember what a tyrant is? Somebody who takes power outside of the law, often violently. This guy did it, but he was also the first to raise government money to help support the arts and architecture and sculpture and things like that.
They would pay the people that came, right?
Yeah. What do you think that was?
Solon equal.
No.
Equal law. Right.
Yeah, Solon's equal laws.
And the end of the dead slave.
All right, try another easy one. Who does the fully developed system of Athena? Pardon?
You drew the
arrow.
Oh, sorry. I meant Solon. Right. Yep. Okay. First written laws in Athens. Who do you think they are?
Draco.
Yeah. We're also governed as a tyrant. Okay. Full democracy in Athens.
Cleisthenes.
That's Cleisthenes. So obviously, the last one.
is Pisistratus.
Okay. Now, one last thing. Do you know? You know how your heaters at home have steam engines on them, right? Okay. The ancient Greeks had a fully working, small-scale industrial steam engine. There are people who believe that the Greeks could have started factory industry as we understand it over 2,000 years ago. By 160 BC, they had the science. Why didn't they do it?
They had slaves
to do the dirty work. That's one reason. Not only that, in order to get a steam boiler going, what do you need to heat the water?
Fire.
You need a fire, which needs some fuel, okay? What do you think they were doing all over the Mediterranean world in order to build ships? They're stripping the hillsides of what? Trees. Enough fuel left over? No. There's one more answer. It has to do with the science of metallurgy.
They
not have the technology to make large-scale steam engines?
That's right. They didn't. They tried it. And guess what happened to the boilers? They burst. Ouch. Yes. Dangerous. All right. The metallurgy wasn't there yet to build large-scale engines of the sort. So there were these little steam toys. Oh, toot toot. How cute.
They didn't know how to apply it either.
Well, that's it. Yeah, they didn't know how to apply it. Yes, ma'am.
And then they also regarded trade and manufacturing as less dignified than sound research.
Yeah, there was that tendency too. That's right. Tinkering with machines was not as noble as pure philosophy. That was another problem. Snobbishness. Good going, girl. Once again, you've had the last word. Hey, guys, above all else, listen to me closely before you go. I know you're stirring, you're anxious to get out of here. After all this torture I put you through today, I guess I don't blame you. That having been said, of all the handouts that you have in this unit, which one must you grab onto and study and hang the review sheet?
I've never got one.
Stick around. We can equip you.
Could I get one also?
Yes. Anybody who thinks he or she is missing one of these suckers should stay here and collect one. Absolutely, yes. Until next time, ladies and gentlemen, stay well.